Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. And today, March 8th, is International Women's Day. And this year, more people are noticing, at least partly because of the election of Donald Trump, an appalling development to so many women. An international action taking place today is called Day Without a Woman, on which participating women are refraining from paid or unpaid work, largely to raise awareness of the economic impact of women's work, yes, paid and unpaid. Listeners, if you are taking part in the strike today, you'll get first priority on the phones for this stretch. Call us at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And we'll take other callers, too. But the rest of you, hold off for a few minutes. Let's see if anyone participating in the action by staying home from paid work or in any other way happens to be listening and wants to call in. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. But among the lessons of Trump's election was that for many, mostly white American women, being female is not a liberal cause. Joining us now as your calls are coming in is Susan Chira, senior correspondent and editor on gender issues for The New York Times, and she writes about this. Susan, thanks so much for coming on. Welcome to WNYC today.
My pleasure, Brian. Thanks for having me.
In December, you wrote, a majority of white women voted for Donald Trump, shattering myths of female solidarity and the belief that demeaning women would make a politician unelectable. What parts of female solidarity do you think, with this much hindsight now, was shown to be a myth?
Well, I think that one of the reasons I wrote that piece is that I talked to a lot of political scientists who said that the presumption that women would vote in what was perceived to be women's interests or for a woman candidate or it together as women for any cause was to a large degree a myth, and that if you look at actual voting patterns, political party has always trumped, to make a bad pun, ideology. Has always trumped, you know, gender solidarity. And so basically the idea is that actually women don't vote as a bloc, and they don't have, in general, haven't demonstrated that they'll, say, place gender interest above political interest.
You spent time after the election doing a series of in-depth interviews, a half hour to an hour each, with individual women who voted for Trump. And one of your takeaways was how important it was not to reduce people to stereotypes. What were some of your other main takeaways?
Yes, those interviews were really fascinating. And I think one of the things that came out is that, you know, women define their self-interest in a lot of different ways. A lot of the women that I talked to, you know, were more interested in, will a president produce well-paying jobs, either for me or for the men in my life, than will that president, you know, be a woman, or will that president prioritize, you know, equal pay, which people support, but they had different priorities. And so I think, and the other big thread that came through was fear, national security, concern about immigration. These were very strong threads that pushed a number of women to Trump rather than Clinton. They were worried about security, and so the whole idea of sort of national security, which some people are conflating with immigration, with border security, with terrorism, Trump resonated more strongly for those women. But I also thought that the interview showed, you know, people are very complex. They could very much support what you think of as issues of women's equality and equal rights and dignity for women and not like many of the remarks he made, but still support him ultimately because either they hated Hillary Clinton or they liked his priorities better. And they were very complex individuals. Sorry.
You haven't yet mentioned race, and of course, 53% of white women voted for Donald Trump, 5% or something like that of black women, and a small percentage of Latino women.
I think race is hugely important. I actually interviewed white women. I selected them deliberately because of that very statistic. And none of the women that I spoke to was overtly dealing with the idea of race. But race has been a huge undercurrent in multiple ways. I think that it's demonstrably true that many working class men and women have seen themselves as people who were not being taken care of. And poor people or people of color or immigrants were getting, you know, programs and government help, and they were not, in their view. And so there's racial undercurrents, certainly, but I also think it's misleading and sweeping to simply dismiss their votes as purely, you know, from racial prejudice. That's a caricature. But there's also race is a really interesting factor within the liberal women's movement. There's enormous amount, I think, of ferment going on right now between women of color who were resentful that in the past issues that affected them, such as Black Lives Matter, were not necessarily taken up by the many white women who flooded the streets for the Women's March when they perceived their own self-interest at risk. So there were also schisms among liberal or left women.
Right. And you noted in the December article that a challenge for the Democratic Party is to court the white working class women who voted solidly for Trump without alienating black women still smarting over white women voting for a man who so many saw as racist. So how do you see that challenge in practical terms? Is it about embracing policies that could be racially divisive, favoring white women at the expense of black women to win the white women back? Or can you put it in those terms?
Well, I think that's one of the great challenges for the movement. And I've talked to a number of leaders about that. And what they're saying is, I think there are several steps they think can be taken. Their hope is to be inclusive, that is, to keep benefiting black women and Latino women and, you know, women who are in low-paid jobs who are often exploited, but at the same time, try to think about what policies would make white working-class women and working-class men feel that their concerns are being heard. You know, it shouldn't be a zero-sum game. There should be a way in the idea of these organizers to make these issues, to make more common ground. That is challenging, though, because resources are limited. And as we see, actually, with the Obamacare healthcare bill, in some ways what's happening with that bill is certain resources are being moved from poor people over to middle-class people. So, you know, it's one thing in theory and another thing in practice.
Nicole in West Orange, you're on WNYC. Hi, Nicole. Thanks so much for calling.
Hi. Thanks.
So are you participating in a day without a woman today?
Yes. Well, in my own way. I have four young children, so I obviously can't take the day off from being their mother and caring for them. But we have made some decisions today on ways to be standing up for all women in solidarity by wearing red. And we tried to actually, we asked our principal at our school and the superintendent if we could stand kind of outside the school and welcome the teachers who are women to school this morning, because they're not able to strike in New Jersey. And these teachers have not had a contract for 600 days, so we really feel strongly that they need to be supported. And we were told this morning that that was not, or yesterday I was told that that was not possible, that they have to remain neutral. And that's a little bit hard for me. I do understand on one hand, but on one hand, to remain neutral on women. And today is International Women's Day. So instead, I baked brownies and brought them in this morning for all the women staff at the school. And I participated in a yoga class with my female friend who owns a yoga studio today. I will be meeting at a local park for a women's rally this afternoon with women. And then we're having a little march after school with all the children who wanted to do the activism this morning to march with American flags and signs celebrating our teachers and women from our school to a playground.
Nicole, Thank you very much. Let's go to Catherine in Westchester. Catherine, you're on WNYC. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for having me. So I'm participating in the Women's day for a number of reasons. I actually am not working, but I'm only working to advance social justice causes. I am an elected county legislator, and I've been working on a paid family leave bill in Westchester County that I'm hoping to have some conference calls with some stakeholders on. But the real reason that I'm participating is that I think that the world really undervalues women's work, and I would like to see that changed. I think that the world is run on unpaid and unappreciated women's labor, and this is a really good opportunity for us to make sure that people know the significance of women's work.
Catherine, thank you very much. Diana in Little Ferry, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Good morning. Fortunately, I'm taking the day off. I work at a doctor's office, and I'm not going to work today. I have three sons. One is in college and two are in high school, and they got up this morning and made breakfast, and they understand why I'm taking the day off. I'm a widow. My husband died suddenly in 2007, and in 2008, we lost our house because of Hurricane Sandy in Little Ferry, New Jersey. So I'm in the middle. I don't qualify for subsidized Medicaid for my children and I, and it's too expensive to pay for health insurance. And even if we get any tax credits, it's not going to work out. I can't afford it. I'm $40,000 a year. I just can't afford it for myself and three boys. So I'm tired of the politicians. It's the same dog with a different collar. They're just moving around, like your speaker said. They take from the poor. If it's a Republican, they take from the poor and give to the rich. If it's a Democrat, they take from the rich and give to the poor. We the people should end it. All men are created equal. Just give us the same insurance that all senators and congresspeople have. Give it to everybody in the United States, and then eliminate all these problems and the drama and going back and forth with trivial little things when there's other things in the world that we could be paying attention to.
You did say you work at a doctor's office, right?
Yes.
And how's your doctor employer with you taking today off?
Very supportive. He was very supportive. He told the three of us that if we wanted to take the day off, we could. I do the billing in the office. He doesn't have office hours today, Wednesday. So, you know, and so one of the girls does filing, the other one does appointments and things like that, and I do the billing.
Very old-fashioned doctor. I don't work Wednesdays.
But a lot of them don't.
You brought up Obamacare. Do you see that as tied in to your taking the day off for International Women's Day?
Not only for International Women's Day, and if you notice, in the United States, they've only been celebrating that for the last couple of years because it was a holiday that was celebrated by other countries and maybe the socialist-leaning ones. Not only that, and it's not boycotting. I see everybody on Facebook saying we're boycotting. No, we're exercising our right to exercise our freedom of speech by not going into work today, by letting the world notice that women count and women matter. And sadly, and I understand from your speaker, 53% of white women voted for Mr. Trump, even after seeing how he treated women on television and everything else. And you know, it's politics is a roller coaster. And sadly, I think the individual person hurts our democracy, but it hurts everyone. It disenfranchises people, and you know, you get disgusted and you just want to walk away. I want to raise my boys morally correct, so when they get married, treat their wives correctly. When they're out there working in the business world, if they see a lady elbow to elbow with the same intelligence and works ethics, that lady should be paid the same thing, not be paid less because she's a mom and her husband is the main breadwinner. Or, you know, let's just look at the Constitution. Look what our founding fathers said.
Diane.
Equal protection. We're all men are equal. Let's do that. Not like these Congress people. I honestly, I was shocked that the American people voted in, not so much Mr. Trump, but voted in those same Republican senators and Congress people who ignored President Obama. And I'm independent. I'm not going either way. President Obama's nomination, pursuant to the Constitution, his duty was to nominate someone for the Supreme Court when the late Justice Scalia passed.
Diana, I'm going to leave it there, and I thank you very, very much. As we continue with Susan Chira, senior correspondent and gender editor at The New York Times. Susan, what are you thinking as you hear our group of callers so far?
Yeah. Well, I think what's fascinating is, and I think what the people who designed the women's strike
observance wanted to do is it offer people a range of options. Not everyone can afford to refrain from going to work. So they're offering a kind of menu for people to do different things, and your caller showed the range of that menu. I think one thing that will be very interesting today is figuring out, is there economic impact? We probably will not be able to assess that today. How widely was it observed? And does it shed light on the ability to sustain the kind of fervor that the Women's March suggested exists out there? Those are all long-term questions as we assess what role women are playing in the so-called resistance to President Trump.
You wrote an article last month previewing today, provocatively titled, "Since When Is Being a Woman a Liberal Cause?" Was that related to your findings in those interviews with women who voted for Trump?
Yeah, I mean, I felt I've been continually interested in giving voice to conservative women and trying to understand their posture toward the women's movement, toward feminism, toward President Trump. And so in thinking over some of my interviews, it felt like there were a lot of people who felt disenfranchised, particularly by the Women's March decision to exclude as partners anyone who was against abortion rights. So a lot of women who otherwise either didn't like President Trump or who had solidarity in other causes that the Women's March embraced didn't feel welcome or didn't want to participate because of that. So there are schisms even among, you know, areas where there may be some common ground about divisive issues like abortion.
Philippe in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Philippe.
Good morning. I always call and tell you you're the best show ever throughout the United States.
Thank you very
However,
much.
However, I have to bring you on one issue.
Okay.
When you did the 30 issues in 30 days, my son said, why don't you call him and tell him that? And it's very hard to get through. Most times I'm listening to you on the internet.
Real quick on that, since it's sort of ancient history now, and we're on this, but real quick.
However, I only bring it up because in the 30 issues in 30 days, we thought you should have What's Wrong with White American Women. The best guest so far you've had on that issue, I think, has been Jessica Crispin, which it would be great to bring her back on, because one of the issues we're not discussing, and I agree with your guest, Ms. Chira, however, one of the things we do not talk about in this country is the undergirth of racism and how white women continue to be used as a scapegoat by white men for what they do. It's all about protecting our men, our women and children. And then the white women turn around and say it's all about protecting our children. I couldn't agree more with your previous caller, Jane. I think she is on the ball. I wish more of our country felt that way.
Philippe, thank you very much. Critique any time. Chris in Tarrytown, you're on WNYC. Hi, Chris. Chris, you there? Chris once. Chris twice. Jennifer in Garrison, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Thank you for calling.
I am a farmer and also an entrepreneur, small food entrepreneur. And while I am trying to participate as best I can, my chickens and my sheep, all of whom are female, all need to be fed. And last night, there was a lot of soul-searching that I did to try to figure out how I could participate and support this action as we have the march in the past, while still doing what we needed to get done. So I offered to the women who work for me to take the day off, but I myself am compelled to work, must work. It's imperative that I work. And I hope that actions in the future take place on weekends so that more of us can speak out. But we all are participating as best we can and are resisting as best we can in the life that we have. So
maybe the next action needs to be a day without farm workers.
I don't know about that.
But not aimed at you, aimed at big agribusiness.
Well, yeah. We are a small farm, and we pay livable wages, and we hire locally for both our farm and our jam business. So,
how hard was it for you to decide to offer your female employees today off, considering the nature of the work?
Well, initially thought that people were going to simply take the day off, but I realized as an employer that I needed to reach out and give voice to my support and say that it was okay and that I, even though they know where I'm coming from on it, that it would be okay and that they were safe in acting out and would have my support.
Jennifer, go ahead.
No, so that was the conversation that I basically had to have with myself yesterday, and how I could get over my own guilt of not being more personally supportive by striking. Would that mean that I was essentially a strike breaker? And then I realized, well, no, we all have to participate in this resistance and in resisting where we are, who we are, how we are. And this is how I'm doing it.
Thank you so much, Jennifer. I really appreciate it. Miriam in Midtown, you're on WNYC. Hi, Miriam.
Hi.
What do you want to add? Are you striking today?
I am. I took the day off. I work for a small nonprofit that helps survivors of domestic violence and sexual assault. Everyone else is working today because we have to take care of this extremely important women's rights issue. I'm in outreach, so I took the day off to participate in the rallies and make sure that Muslim immigrant women are represented and there.
Mm-hmm. Considering the work you do, was it hard to decide to take the day off?
We're a feminist organization, so I could have attended on behalf of my organization, but I just wanted to do this for myself.
Are you feeling any of the tension between sort of race and class, different groups of women, you know, as has been in the conversation?
We feel it every day. We were feeling it before Donald Trump won, and so this has only brought things more to the surface. I'm happy that we're having these conversations, and I hope that we can continue to come together as women, whether we're women of color or white women. I'm seeing a really strong support system and people becoming more intersectional, and that's exactly what we need right now.
Thank you so much for your call. I appreciate it. As we continue with Susan Chira, senior correspondent and gender editor at the New York Times. Again, Susan, any reaction to any of that series of callers before I ask anything else?
I think it's more of the same. It's just fascinating to see the infinite variety. I mean, a farm worker, you can't stop. Someone who has to search her soul to say, you know, there are women who need help. Is it okay for me not to be there for one day for another cause?
How much do you see the tension that the caller Philippe brought up in today's action? Some people have criticized it by dubbing it a day without upper middle class white women.
Yes,
because
exactly.
That's who actually has enough flexibility at their jobs and in their budgets to participate. Others say you can see it as women of relative privilege using that privilege to stand up for all women. So how much tension, how much unity?
I think that I don't know the answer to that question yet, because I need to keep reporting today to see who turns up and who doesn't, to the extent that we can assess it. But I think one of the things that people have mentioned is the very successful Fight for 15, that is the demonstrations and protests that took place about raising the minimum wage, which was waged as a strike by low-paid workers. So their argument is that, you know, people of limited means have used strikes as tools so that it does not have to be confined entirely, exclusively to privileged women. But I do agree that, you know, this is a criticism many have made, that it is extremely hard for people. They might get fired, they might get docked pay that they can't afford. So I do think that there is some bite to that criticism, but I also think that the organizers of this action are aware and are trying to provide various ways to participate without, you know, putting yourself at risk. But yeah, the issue of privilege and lack of privilege is a big schism in this movement, and there are a lot of questions about how to bring these groups together. A
couple of quick things before you go. Women are, as you wrote last week, emerging as the most active standard bearers of the resistance to this presidency. And as we all know, the highly successful protest on the day after the election was organized as a women's march. Is there evidence it was the beginning of a sustained reawakening?
I think that's the most important and fascinating question that I'll be examining again later today. I do believe there's some evidence that's really interesting. One, women were very, very active in the movements to confront members of Congress during recess to speak out about health care changes that they thought would hurt them. Women have been involved in, many of the protests, and women have some women from the Women's March have gone back to their communities and tried to start groups that I wrote about called huddles, that are essentially small groups that try to brainstorm about what actions they can take politically or in their communities. So I think that the Women's March provided its organizers with the beginning of a network that they and affiliate groups are attempting to continue to engage in political protest and action. We don't know what that adds up to yet entirely, but I see the stirrings of it, certainly.
And last thing, I see you wrote an article this week called Sexist Political Criticism Finds a New Target, Kellyanne Conway. And you drew parallels between the way she's being depicted and how Hillary Clinton was. What are you seeing?
Well, what I tried to point out is that when we look at powerful, assertive women, culturally, we still seem to have a very sad tendency to criticize them in overtly sexist terms, how they appear, sexualized connotations, you know, what their hair looks like, what their makeup looks like. My point was not, some people have misunderstood it in the comments, to say one cannot criticize these women, love them or hate them. The point is how we criticize them, and that comes from women as well as from men. And I just wanted to point out that there were remarkable parallels, even though the two women are poles apart ideologically, and, you know, people who hate them may have ample reason to dislike what they do. But let's not revert to these sexist ways that have been used to attack and undermine women's effectiveness. You can criticize them in terms that don't use those kinds of images and demeaning comparisons.
And even that has run a little bit along class lines, because there are people who say it's sexist to criticize the way Kellyanne Conway sat on a couch, because you'd never criticize the way a man sits on a couch. On the other hand, there are people who say, well, she wouldn't have felt licensed to sit so casually at a White House meeting if it wasn't with a group of black leaders. If it was with white CEOs, she would have felt compelled to sit more formally. So even that has its strains.
Yes, that stream of criticism, which I think is does not fall into that sexist category. There were questions raised about respect. Interestingly, our White House photographer, New York Times White House photographer, was there, said that she was actually leaning back in part to do a cell phone photograph for the participants. And so it's all very much what you saw when you saw. But the question of respect has been raised.
Susan Chira is senior correspondent and gender editor for The New York Times. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come.